We're holding uncouth bays, onward bays, eight, nine lines from the bottom. We talked yesterday about where you have an argument between a landlord and a tenant about the terms of the rental, where you have where he said it's by the year and he said it's by the month, and we said the question is what happens as far as the extra month, who's entitled to the rent for that. So now the Gemara brings a related point. What about if the tenant says I already paid the rent and the landlord says you didn't pay, I didn't receive the rent? Almila, who would have to bring the proof that who would have to bring the proof? Would we say that the landlord has to bring the proof that he hadn't been paid, and only then does the tenant have to pay, or the other way around? So the Gemara asks, but before we even get to the answer, we have to figure out the situation. Amos, what are we talking about? Ibasech zmanai, if it's during the time, but during the time of the rental, during let's say, for example, there was a lease for a year, and we're talking about during the year, tanena, then we have a Mishnah that bears on that. Ila'achas mana tanena. And if it's after the time, then also we have a Mishnah that bears on it. So when they asked Rabbi Yanai, implying that the people who asked him were not stam talking about Amei Orech, these are people who know the relevant Mishnayos, so they should, or and Brisos, so they would be able to have the answer for themselves. So once we figure that out, then we'll be able to know what the answer is. So the Tanan, we learn in a Mishnah in Masechta Bechoros regarding Pidyon HaBen. The Mishnah says, now we know Pidyon HaBen doesn't kick in until the baby is 30 days old. So the Mishnah says, Mesa'av, if the father died within the 30 days, nifta, then we have a chazaka that the baby was not that had not had Pidyon HaBen. And therefore, so it's the father's mitzvah to do it. So therefore, so if the father didn't do it, then later on, then later on, when the child gets older, if nobody else has arranged it on his behalf, then he's going to have to arrange his own pidyon haben. Adchi yovi raya shenifta, unless the son is able to bring proof that, for example, Edim, that he was in fact redeemed. Meaning, in other words, now it's possible for the father to pay the five sloim to the kohen before the child is 30 days old, but it's not likely to. It's more likely that he's going to wait until the end of the 30 days and only then pay. So therefore, by default, we would assume that he didn't do it within the 30 days, and therefore that the son later on is going to have to arrange it himself. But if the father dies after the baby is 30 days old, then we have a chazaka that he was redeemed. Unless people tell the baby that in fact he wasn't redeemed. So that would mean, in other words, for example, they tell him that your father informed us before he passed away that he didn't have a chance to redeem you. Whereas in the first case, we don't even need, for example, let's say we don't need Edim. We could have, for example, if he has some other kind of proof. He has, let's say, for example, a document where the Kohen wrote out to him, I received the five sloim from you, then that would also be a solid proof that he did. Rashi points out, you can't now, the first part of it is you're saying the boy would have to be bringing the proof that he had been redeemed, and if not, then he's on the hook for the five sloim himself. In the second case, we can't say that after 30 days, we should have it up to the Kohen to bring the proof, because there's many kohanim out there. It doesn't have to be that the father did the pidyon haben with one particular kohen. So therefore, instead, the Mishnah phrases it, ad sheyomru lo, unless other people tell the son that the father hadn't been paid to him before. And then once they inform him, then that's enough proof. Then that's enough proof. And on top of that, also, since you have a chazaka that most people don't pay within the time, so therefore, when they tell him shaloi nifta, that he wasn't redeemed, then he would in fact have to do it. So we see, in other words, that a person is normally not going to pay what he's responsible for during the time, only when the time comes due. Well, then, in that case, so here, when you have the landlord and the tenant are arguing whether the rent is paid, all we have to do is see, is it during the time of the lease or is it not? And then we'll have the answer based on that Mishnah. That, by the way, is Rashi's Girsa over here, and Tosfos's. On the other hand, Agos HaGrah points out the Rif and the Rosh have a completely different Girsa in the Gemara over here, not bringing in this matter of Pidyon HaBen, but rather bringing in a Braisa that talks about if within the 30 days, assuming that the lease is for 30 days, then the chazaka is he didn't pay unless he brings a proof that he did and vice versa. So in other words, according to them, the Gemara is not bringing a proof from a Mishnah as far as Pidyon HaBen, but rather from a Braisa that is talking about actual landlord-tenant relationships. Anyway, the point is, why are they asking Rav Yana? So the answer is loy tzricha, yes, but the chiddush, the reason why they need to ask the question is the yoma de mishlam zimne. If the argument between the landlord and the tenant comes up on the actual day when the time is up. So it was, let's say, a 30-day lease, and now on that 30th day, then they're arguing whether he paid it or not. The Ritva actually says there are some who say that we're talking about the next day, because in other words, you'd have full 30 days and the next day is when the rent is due. In any case, that's the question. So now the question is, mi ovid inish to pora b'yoyim de mishlam zimne, is a person apt to pay on the actual day that his obligation comes in? In other words, we're going to say up until 30 days, he's not yet chayav to pay, because the Gemara elsewhere mentions schiros ein mishtalemus elul of a soif, that the rental or the fee for renting or hiring or whatever something or hiring a worker is usually only payable at the end. So during the first 29 days, he's definitely not chayav to pay yet. On the 30th day, he becomes chayav. Is it likely that he actually paid on that day, or was it more likely that he didn't actually pay that day, and therefore on that 30th day, then the landlord could have a valid claim, I wasn't paid yet? So that would be the question. So Amalahu Rabbi Yochanan, said Rabbi Yochanan, who was Rabbi Yana's Talmud, answered to these people who were asking, Tinisuha. Well, we have a Mishnah. It's true, the Mishnah in Bechoros, or the Braisa about rentals doesn't apply to this, because they were talking about long after the 30 days versus before. But Tinisua, we do have a Mishnah later on in our Masechta at the end, towards the end of the next parak, that bears on this, where the Mishnah says, at the end of the next parak, one of the topics we're going to be talking about is the mitzvah. The Torah tells us you have to pay a worker on time. So the Mishnah describes over there, socher, a hired worker, bizmanoi, in his time, meaning, in other words, if he demands his pay on the day that he finished his work, nishba v'noito, then he can swear that he hasn't received it yet, and then he can collect it. The point is, in other words, that now we've learned before, the whole concept of swearing in order to collect is only medirabanon. So we're going to learn at the end of the next parak, when we learn this on daf kufyud aleph, kufyud beis, that the idea is the chachamim, the Chachamim said, in this case, we're not going to allow the Balabas to swear and be potter from paying, because he's busy and he may not realize who he paid among his workers and who he didn't. He may not keep careful track. Whereas the worker himself, since he worked hard for this money and even maybe put his life on the line, therefore he's going to be much more careful and claim it. And we can assume that when he swears, he's going to do that only if he knows for sure that he didn't receive it. So bizmano, in his time, nishba v'noto, then he can swear and he can collect. As opposed to if he comes sometime later, then we don't say that. So the point is, Rabbi Yochanan says, "Sochehu deromu rabbanon shvua ale." When it comes to a hired worker, the Chachamim imposed the shvua on him. Instead of the normal thing would be to say that, "Look, hamotzi mechaver l'maraya, you worker want to claim from the employer that he owes you money." The normal thing we would say is the employer should swear that he doesn't owe the money, and then he'd be potter. Here instead, the Chachamim are flipping it around and say that the and saying that the worker should swear, because again, the Balabais may be busy with his other workers and whatever and not realize whether he actually paid or not, whereas the worker is going to know good and well. And the reason is, yeah, Mishum de Balabais toted Bapoyalov, because the worker, because the boss is busy with his other workers. So he may, in other words, he may mistakenly think that he paid and even end up swearing falsely on it, genuinely thinking that he paid, and it's going to turn out that not, as opposed to the socher is going to know for sure. So that's what Rabbi Yochanan said. That applies over there, because a special takana on behalf of the worker. Aval hocha, but over here, where the tenant is claiming that he paid earlier in the day, soicha mehemen b'shvua, then we should believe the tenant with a shvua. Then we should say the normal situation where he can. The normal situation is that you swear in based in your potter from paying. So here also, therefore, the soicha should be the one who swears that he already paid the rent, and then he'd be potter. Or actually, it wouldn't actually be a shvur daraisa, because we're talking about kofar hakol, but and because also we're talking about karka, but rather Rashi points out it would be a shvur's hesis. It'd be a shvur's hesis, the regular shvur derabanan, when a person is denying a claim in based in, so he would take that shvur's hesis and then he'd be potter. Okay, so that's the answer in short. In other words, if there's an argument between the landlord and the tenant whether the rent was paid or not. So if the argument comes up before the time of the rental is over, then we believe the landlord, because people don't usually pay within their time. If it's long afterwards, then we believe the tenant, because people usually do pay. And if it's on the day itself, then the tenant would have to, then in all cases, when we say we believe him, we mean he'd have to swear a Shvuas Hesis. And if it's on the day itself, then also we would make the tenant swear a Shvuas Hesis. Okay. The Gemara says, "Amar Rava, Amar Rav Nachman, Hayman de Oygulei Beisa L'Chavri La'Esa Shonin." If a person rented a house to somebody else for 10 years, V'Kosav Le'Shtara, and he wrote out a lease document for 10 years. Now the scenario is Rashi is going to explain, and we're going to say soon that Tosfos brings from Rabbeinu Chananel a different explanation. So according to Rashi, the scenario is the shtar says that it's a rental for 10 years, but it doesn't say when that 10 years begins, and therefore when it ends. So now later on, you have an argument. Later on, the landlord says to the tenant, you've been here 5 years already, and therefore you only have another 5 years to go. Meanwhile, the tenant is claiming that he's been there only 3 years. Now, it has to be 3 years minimum, because otherwise, what the Gemara is going to talk about over here in terms of the dinim of chazaka is not going to apply, because it needs 3 years to establish chazaka. But the point is, in other words, he's claiming that he's been there only 3 years, and the landlord's claiming that he's been there longer than that, and therefore it's closer to the end of the 10 years. So Rava says Meheman, we would believe the tenant, we would believe the landlord rather, and therefore he only has 5 more years. And the reason is because karka b'cheskas ba'aleh ha'emedes, because the land is in the chazaka of its owner. So therefore, when we have a suffix like this, then we have to go according to the chazaka of the fact that the owner, we know that the landlord owns it. But the Gemara says, "Omalei Rav Achmi Difti L'Ravina Elameata." By that logic that you're saying that we believe the landlord, and we say therefore that it means half the time is gone already. By that logic, are you going to say the same thing with other kinds of shtaris? Oisfe Meya Zuzi B'Shtara. What if one person lends another 100 zuz with a shtar? But Omalei Praticha Palga, and later on the loiva says, "I paid half of it off." Hachinami de Mehemon, are you going to tell me he's going to be believed? Of course not. That's classic Moedim Mitzvah. We're going to make him take a Shavua in Beis Din. Why should it be any different over here? In effect, that's what it is. We say we have a 10-year lease over here. The landlord is saying half of it is already gone. The tenant is saying no, less than half is gone. Why should we just believe him on the grounds of Karka B'Cheskas Ba'alel? So Omalei, so Ravina answers to Rav Achmi Difti, Hachi Hashta, how are you thinking to compare? The difference is a shtar is meant to be collected with. The purpose of the shtar is fundamentally in order to be able to prove that there was a debt over here and eventually be able to collect with it. Im issa de pare, if in fact he had paid off half the loan, then he should write on the shtar itself, the shtar says, I owe you $100, but now I only owe you $50. Or he would write a receipt. The malva would write out a receipt for half the debt, and the loiva would keep it. The machloekas in other places in Shas, whether postman shover, whether in general we say when a debt is partially paid off, is it, or even completely paid off, is it valid for the malva to say to the loiva? We talked about this at the end of the first parak. Is it valid for the malva to say to the loiva, I don't have the shtar right now to return to you, but you pay me up anyway, and I'll write you out a receipt, and you're going to have to keep a hold of that receipt. Is that valid, or can the loiva say that, no, I shouldn't be obligated to forever after keep this receipt, rather until you can give me the shtar so we can rip it up or write on it or whatever, then I'm not paying you back. So in any case, here we're saying if you write a receipt, then fine, you write a receipt. If not, then you write on the shtar itself. And the fact that you didn't do that gives us good reason to say that, in fact, none of the debt was paid off, and therefore we're not going to believe the loiva at his word that he paid off half the debt. He's going to have to swear the shvur of a moedim mitzvah. So Ravina says that's in that case, then, that you're asking about from that. Aval hocha, but over here, the purpose of the shtar is something else altogether. Omale, the landlord, can say, haydik sivilach shtara, the fact that I wrote you out a shtar in the first place, not that you should be able to, you're always going to be able to pull out the shtar and say that you still have most of the 10 years left. The reason is, kihechi d'letech sakale, the reason is precisely so you don't come to make a chazak on it. Like this, if you have, you lived here 3 years or more, you're going to end up claiming you have a chazak on it, and as we're told in Bava Basra, which we're going to get to in a few weeks, Bez Hashem, 3 years is enough to create a chazaka, and now you're not obligated even to hold on to your shtar anymore, because we can't assume that a person is going to hold on to a shtar indefinitely. So the landlord says, I wrote this shtar precisely so that after 3 years, you're not able to claim that you have a chazaka on this place. Rather, we'll have the shtar and we'll see that it was only a rental. But that doesn't show that I still owe you 7 years left. In fact, I'm claiming that no, it means that you've already gone through half the time and there's only half the time left. So therefore that brings us to what Rava had said, that in fact we would believe therefore we have the question, who do we believe? And the answer is because the land is a machazaka of the owner, of the landlord, therefore his claim is believed, and in fact there's only 5 years to go. So that's all Rashi's explanation and Tosfos brings from that. Rabbeinu Hanano brings that as a first explanation as well. Mefarshim have some difficulties with it. For one thing, the Ritva points out, what good is it going? First of all, why would the shtar be in the hands of the tenant then? If anything, the shtar should be in the hands of the landlord. If you leave it in the hands of the tenant, what's he going to do? After 3 years, he can hide the shtar, pretend that it never existed, and start claiming chazaka. So what good would that do? If anything, if you want the shtar to be a permanent proof that there's only a rental here and not a sale, then the masker should be holding on to it. So Tosfos brings a second explanation from Rabbeinu Hanan. We're talking about that the shtar does say the date in it. It does say that that on such and such a date, Pliny rented from Pliny this property for 10 years. What it is now, later on, the argument is similar to what we had before in the Gemara about whether the rental fee was paid or not. Where now the argument is where the soicher, the tenant, is saying, I've already paid you for 5 years, and the other one is saying that no, you have paid me for less. You haven't paid me anything at all, or you paid me only a lesser amount of it. So then we would say that the socher would be believed with a shvur. So in Rashi's scenario, we're saying that we would believe the maskir, and he would be the one who, and therefore we would say there's only 5 years left to go. In this scenario, according to Rabbeinu Hananel's second explanation, we would say fakir, the maskir is holding on to the shtar. Now the socher says, I've already paid you for 5 years. The maskir says that you paid me for only 3 years. So Rabbah is telling us that we believe the tenant. So now Rabbi Achami Difti asks why, in the case of a regular shtar chayv, we believe the one who's holding the shtar chayv. And the answer is because the difference is that there the shtar chayv is meant to collect with, Whereas here, it's mainly more in order to prevent a chazaka. And in fact, the girsa is slightly different. In the Gemara over here, you have that the landlord says to the tenant, so that I don't have a chazaka, so that you don't come and claim a chazaka, having lived here for 3 years, according to the second explanation of Rabbi Nachmanano, that Tosfos brings, the girsa would be that the tenant says to the landlord, the shtar was written so that I am not going to end up making chazaka on your land, but nevertheless, the fact that you have the shtar doesn't show that I owe you for the entire 10 years. You wrote out the shtar, and you're holding on to the shtar only to prevent me from making a chazaka, but not to be able to claim always that I owe you the full 10 years of rent. Tosfos points out, in fact, that seems to fit better with the flow of the Gemara over here, because we've just been talking about things like that, about who we believe in cases of arguments about the responsibility between the landlord and the tenant, whereas according to Rashi and according to Rabbeinu Hananel's first explanation, that we're talking about the argument how long he's been there and how long he has left to go, then it doesn't really fit with the flow of the rest of the sugya. Okay. Now, getting back to matters of borrowing, where after all this pedic was Hashoyla Sapora, and we were talking about dinim of borrowing and about renting. So now let's get back to a dinim of borrowing. Omer Rav Nachman, Shoyal Adam Betuvoy La'olam. A person is allowed to borrow Betuvoy forever. Rashi explains that Betuvoy means when the keli, as long as the keli is still good to you. So a person sees that somebody else has a keli, and he asks him, lend that to me as long as that keli is still functional. So if the other guy agrees, then normally we say she'ela is only for a certain amount of time, generally only for 30 days. But here where he says betuvoy, then it means, and the other guy agreed, and as the Gemara is going to go on to say, where we have a kinyan about it, then it means he's allowed to continue using it indefinitely as long as it's still functional. And that means, Rashi says, even after he returned it, so he may need this keli only for a short amount of time, and then he returns it, he would still be entitled, because to begin with, he said that I want to borrow it betuvoy, and the other guy agreed, and we made a kinyan, therefore, at any time, he would be able to borrow it again without asking for permission again. So let's learn the lines of the Gemara, and then we'll talk about, there are several other opinions among Rishonim, what this betuvoy means. Anyway, Omer Rav Mori brother Bas Shmuel, Rav Mori, the son of the daughter of Shmuel, says he's the same Rav Mori that we have in various places in Shas. Rav Mori Bar Rochel, where we know the story, one of Shmuel's daughters was kidnapped by Goyish raiders, and one of them impregnated her, and then later on he became a ger. The father is called Isu Giyoda. In a few places in Shas, the son is not considered related to him in Halacha, because he was conceived when his father was still a goy, and therefore usually in Shas he's called Rav Mori Bar Rochel, and he was called Rav Mori Brod Bas Shmuel. Anyway, he says, "Vahu dekoni minei," only if they made a kinyan on it. If they didn't make a kinyan, then Rashi points out, once he returns it, then he can't borrow it again without permission, because the original mashicha, we learned earlier in this perek, you do mashicha when you first borrow something, and that puts it in your reshus as far as being chayev in the usual responsibilities of a shoyel. But here, when he returned it, then the result of that mashicha is over, and now he would now he can't borrow it again without permission. But if they made a kinyan, then he can continue borrowing it again and again. He would have to return him the handle. Meaning, in other words, Rashi describes that after all, the guy didn't give it to him as a present. He gave it to him as he lent it to him. So eventually, when the thing breaks, then he can't say that, you know what, I'm going to fix it and I'm going to continue using it. He doesn't have the right to do that. So eventually, when it breaks to the point where all that's left is the handle, he is going to have to return, or not really only the handle, Rashi explains, where it's not functional anymore, then he has to return him whatever's left of the keli at that point. So that's all according to Rashi. Tosfos brings an explanation from the Aruch that Shoyal Adam Betuvoy means that he's saying basically that you did me that I did you a favor in the past. So now, in return for that favor, I want to be able to borrow something from you indefinitely. And Tosfos says, "V'ena nira," it doesn't seem like that. So just because you did him a favor, therefore you should be able to borrow it from him indefinitely. So Toysmith doesn't like that explanation. Then there are other explanations. So the Ritva mentions a similar explanation that he had previously done him a favor, and therefore he's saying that. So now, if they made a kinyan, then in other words, so the Ritva explains basically what it would be is if they make a kinyan, then he becomes a shoyl. If they don't make a kinyan, then in effect he's considered a soicher. He's considered like a renter, because then he's trading for you. I previously did you a favor, and now I can use your keli. So therefore, it's more like a soicher. Then you have another explanation. The Rif has a girsa, not betuvoi, but toivoscha. He says, basically, you're a good guy. Are you willing to lend me this thing indefinitely? So the Rosh says, what do you mean? Now, people always say like that. You're a nice guy. Are you willing to lend me? Or are you willing to lend me this thing? There are Mephoshim who in turn explain to for the Rosh's question that we're saying over here that they made a kinyan over here on it. So therefore, that's more of a reason to say that it's not the usual way of doing things to just say. Well, usually it's true. You say Hashileni b'tevoscha. Sure, everybody is going to say, "Do me a favor and lend me this thing." But here we're talking about that. Here we're saying that. The Smeh actually explains. He says Davka when he says, "I know that you're a nice guy. You're not machved on the amount of time that the borrowing would be for. So therefore, can I borrow it basically indefinitely?" So now, when the other guy agrees and they make a kinyan, then that means, in other words, that yes, it's different. So the Rosh is asking, "What do you mean?" People always say you're a nice guy. So the Smeh is saying not just you're a nice guy, but you're not machved on how long somebody borrows it. So you have several different explanations of betuvoi or betuvoscha, and you also have a few different explanations of what the Gemara means when it says that you have to return the handle. So again, Rashi is saying it means, in other words, that you can't. You get that. First of all, it means that even once you return it, you can borrow it again, unless if no kinyan was made, then you can't. So first of all, Hagoyis HaGra points out the Rambam and the Rif are going to understand, even if you didn't return it yet, then still you if you didn't make a kinyan, you're going to have to return it. You're going to have to return it as soon as the guy asks back for it. Whereas if you made a kinyan, then you're allowed to borrow it again and again. And again, as far as the returning the handle, one thing is, in other words, so Rashi says it means you can't fix it because, in other words, you borrowed a keli from him. He didn't sell it or gift it to you or something. And then there's other explanations as far as the handle. What it means, in other words, is that it means even if all that's left is the handle, then at that point you're still using it until that point, until it's completely broken and all that's left is the handle, and then you return him and then you return him that, and then you potter from having to pay anything else. Another din in this connection, as far as borrowing, Omar Rava, Hayman de Omar Lechavre, Ushlan Moral and Mirpak Bay. If a person says to somebody else, "Lend me a shovel to dig with," strictly Mirpak means not just to dig, it means actually to hoe around plants. You dig around the roots to get more air to them and so that the air and the water will get to them better. So now you have a person borrows a spade from somebody else to do that. So if he says, "I want a lemur pakbei high paudesa. I want to use it to hoe in this particular orchard or this particular vineyard." So then, rofik beahu paudesa. He's only allowed to use it in that vineyard. He's not allowed to use it anywhere else because he didn't borrow it for that purpose. On the other hand, paudesa. But if he doesn't say this vineyard, he just says a vineyard. Rofik they call paudesa the boy. Then he could use it to dig to hoe. In any vineyard that he wants. So Rashi says, even if it's a gigantic vineyard, even if it's as big as Rashi says, like the city of Antiochia, which in those times was a very big city, so it was like a symbol of a really gigantic area. The Rambam explains it means that he could even use it to hoe in somebody else's vineyard, meaning, in other words, he might say, "I'm borrowing it not to use it in my own vineyard, but rather in somebody else's." Then he'd still be allowed to do that because he didn't say "Hi Paudesa." He just said Paudesa in general. What about if he says Paudesi? What about if he says that I want to borrow it in order to use it in vineyards, plural. So then, rofik va'azo kol pardesid islay, then he can use it in as many vineyards as he wants. We don't say that it means only two. The word pardesi means in general, however many he wants. Or mahadale kate, and again, at the end, he could return him only the handle, because you could have that in the end, he used it so much that all that's left in the handle is the handle. That's fine, because he said that the terms were, when he borrowed it, that he can use it to hoe in vineyards, meaning as many as he wants, and therefore the other guy can't object and say, well, after you did two or three vineyards or whatever, then that's enough, I want it back. But again, it would have to be that so that would be the din. Tosfos points out there are other places in Shas where we do find that Pardesi means true and no more. But so Tosfos discusses a number of reasons why over here it would be different. For one thing, there we're talking about selling. A person would prefer to sell as little as possible. And Yad L'keach al Tachtoina, whereas over here, we're talking about borrowing, and there's no reason to assume that he meant only two vineyards, and therefore it means as many as he wants. And then again, in other words, so in the end, if all that's left is the handle, then he just returns him the handle. There are, by the way, in the previous case also, and in this case also, there are mephoshim who learn that just the opposite. Mahadale kata means he could continue repairing it, even if, so over time he's repairing it, but still the blade is wearing more and more away. Eventually, all that's going to be left in the hand is the handle. He'd be able to do that, as opposed to a point of Rashi. That it would be fakert, that he can't fix it because he borrowed it only as long as it's functional, and once it breaks and it's not functional anymore at that point, then his she'ela of it is over. Another din in this connection, just like we said, as far as borrowing a spade to dig in vineyards, where we say that he can dig, if he said pardesi, then he can dig in as many vineyards as he wants. So similarly, omer papa, haiman de omer lechavre, if a person says to somebody else, Oishlan hai gargusa, lend me this well. I want to be able to water my fields from it. The nafla, now if that well collapses, loy boni la, then he can't rebuild it. He can't say that, you know what, I'll rebuild it on my expense, and then you'll lend it to me again. The other guy can say, you know what, the deal was, I'm going to lend you this well. Once this well has collapsed, then if you build it, it's going to be like a new thing. So therefore, I'm not obligated to continue lending it to you. On the other hand, gargusa, but if he just says in general, I want to borrow a well from you, and he doesn't specify, v'nafla, now if it collapses, boni la, then he would be allowed to rebuild it, and then he can continue the borrowing with that. And the other guy can't object because until he finishes watering all his fields, it actually explains, because in other words, again, he said gargusa in general, and the other guy didn't object. Be gargusa. And now if the guy says, I want to borrow an area for a gargusa, meaning there's no gargusa there yet, there's no well yet, I want to build one over there. So then, Kori v'ozel, he can continue going and digging kama gargusa, as many wells as necessary, ba'are, in the other guy's land, ad misramile, until he gets one good well. In other words, he'll try digging in one place, he'll find there's no water over there. So now the other guy can't say, well, you tried, tough luck, then I'm not obligated to lend it to you anymore. No, because he had told him, and because, as the Gemara was going to say, he made a kinyan that he's lending him a place for a gargusa, then it has to be a successful gargusa, a successful well, so the guy can sink as many wells as necessary in order for him to actually come up with a place where he gets water. And again, in order for all that to work, there would need to be a kinyan. If there's no kinyan, then the owner of the land could object anytime he wants and say that, no, you had enough tries already, and now I don't want to lend you it anymore. Just verbal words, that actually says, is not enough for that. Okay. Mishnah says, Hamaskir bayis l'chaveira, a person rents a house to somebody else.
Alexander.
Yeah.
How do you prove that there was a kinyan?
Adim or
there has to be Adim, otherwise it's not a valid Kenyan.
Without Adim, it's a valid Kenyan. The Gemara elsewhere says, Lo Ivri Sadi El Mishkori, that witnesses most of the time are needed only in case somebody is going to lie or deny or whatever. But practically speaking, yeah, how would you prove there was a Kenyan without Adim or without a Shtar, sign, or without a Shtar, sign, or without a sign Shtar? So, yeah. And in principle, if you had some other way of proving that there was a Kenyan, then yeah. But whatever the case, there has to be a Kenyan in order for the borrower to be able to hold the shoil to this open ended commitment like that. And practically speaking, to know that there was a Kenyan, you're going to need some kind of proof. Yeah. Okay. Mishnah says, Hamaska bayis l'chaver. A person rents a house to somebody else. Rashi points out we're talking about for a certain particular amount of time. Meaning, in other words, that the dinim that we're going to talk about over here, where he has to, if the house collapses, what he has to do as far as providing him another house, that wouldn't necessarily apply if it was an open-ended rental without a lease. Anyway, for nafal, if the house collapses, chayav lahamid lebayis, then the landlord has to provide him another house to live in until the lease is over. Hoya Kotten, if the original house that he rented him was small, lo yasenu gadol, then the landlord can't decide instead that that I've decided to rebuild the house in bigger dimensions because the tenant can say, you know what, I don't want, actually. I would rather have a house the size that it was before. I don't want a bigger house. Gadol lo yasenu kotten, or vice versa. If it was large, then the landlord can't unilaterally make it smaller. Echad, if it was one room, lo yasenu shnayim, he can't divide it into two rooms, even if it's the same square footage. Shnayim lo yasenu echad, same idea, because in all cases, the tenant can say, listen, I rented from you, we have a lease over here, that I'm renting from you an area that has such and such square footage and so many rooms, and therefore, I want something exactly the same, and you can't go and unilaterally decide to build it on a different plan without my permission. Similarly, lo yifchus min achalonis, he can't reduce the number of windows, lo yosef aleihem, or add to the number of windows, all of this, elamidas shneim, only if the tenant and landlord together agree that to these changes, then they can do that, but the landlord can't do that unilaterally. Well, the Gemara asks, hey chidomi, what exactly is the scenario over here? E de omale bayis zeh, if he told them to begin with that I'm renting you this house, so now when it collapses, what do you mean? Nafal ozalei. So if it collapses, then it's gone. It's the tenant's mazel. And why should the landlord be obligated even to provide a new house? Why should the landlord be obligated even to provide a new house at all? After all, he said bayis zeh, and now it's not a house anymore. Now there are mafoshim will point out we had a case before, for example, where we had a case in an earlier perek where you rented somebody a donkey, and then if the donkey dies, then you have details over there about he has to provide him a new donkey. So actually the ritva brings over here that a rental, when you rent a house, then it's almost like a sale. So therefore, the same way as if you bought a house and it collapsed, you can't go back to the other guy and demand your money back. The same way over here. So first of all, the ritva says the tenant would have to pay no matter what. And actually have Goris Oshri infers from Rashi that says the same thing. On the other hand, the Ramban says that no, you only have to pay for the actual amount of time he used it. And then you have the point that we learned about earlier in the Masechta about, say, for example, when you have you rented a donkey, the Ramban brings up this point that after all, when you rented a donkey, then we said, even if you said chamur zeh, you still said that you still have to sell the nevela and use the money to rent him another donkey for the rest of the time. Why would you not have to take the stones over here and sell them and go use that money to get him another house? So the Ramban explains that when you usually don't sell the house, you usually just rebuild the house from scratch. With a chamur, you usually do. You sell, what else are you going to do with the nevela? You sell it, and therefore you're obligated to do that. As opposed to the stones over here, you're not necessarily going to resell the stones from a collapsed house. You might just throw them away. And also another point is that once the house collapsed, you can't call it bayis zeh, whereas a dead donkey can still be called chamur zeh. Anyway, so the Gemara is saying over here that again, if it was bayis zeh, then why should he be obligated to provide him another house at all? It's the renter's mazel. E d'amalei bayis stam, and if he just told him I'm renting you a house without specifying, then why are we saying amai lo yasenu shnayim katan amai? If he told him I'm renting you a house and the other guy agreed, then he could rent him whatever kind of house he wants. Why shouldn't he be able to rebuild it on a different plan with a different number of rooms or a different size or whatever? So what is the case where the Mishnah is saying, on the one hand, he has to provide him a house, and on the other hand, it has to be on the exact same plan as before? The situation is, says Rish Lakish, where when he rented him the house to begin with, he told him, I'm renting you a house that is X number of feet long. Well, therefore, so now we can't change that. Well, the Gemara says, Yehochi Maila Memra, then what's the Chiddush? Of course, they agreed to begin with. It was going to be a house of exactly this size, so of course he can't change it. So the Gemara answers, Loi Tzricha, no, but the Chiddush is, De Koya Gudad, so rather, I skipped the line. So Eloki also Robin, Omer Rish Lakish, rather, when Robin came from Eretz Yisrael, he reported that Rish Lakish, it's not that he said, Orka Tachakach. What he said is, Omer Rish Lakish, Domele Bais Kazeh Animastu Lacha. The landlord said, I'm renting you a house like this. Well, the question is Vakati Maila Memra. Still, what's the Chiddush? Like this, Pashtus means the same size and the same floor plan. The answer is Loitzricha de Koya Guda Denara. The Chiddush is, let's say the house was located on the riverbank. Mao de Tema. So you might think, my Koze, when he says, I'm renting you a house like this, maybe he means not as far as the size or the number of rooms or the floor plan or anything like that. Maybe he means, Kazeh means the Koya Guda Denara. It means a house like this that's located by the riverbank. Because a house by the riverbank is more important, Rashi points out. For people would usually be mocked by that. So maybe when he says Kazeh, maybe we would assume the tenant doesn't care about the size of the house. He cares about the location, that it's in a prestigious place by the riverbank. And maybe therefore, when the house collapses, then the landlord is allowed to build it on a different plan, as long as he builds it by the riverbank. Kamash Malan, no, therefore we say, when he says Kazeh, he means, Sarashi explains, he means everything, both the floor plan and the location. So yes, he would be obligated to provide him with another house in a similar kind of location by the riverbank, and that's the same size. That's according to Rashi. According to the Ritva brings a slightly different explanation, that maybe in fact he would be he doesn't necessarily have to give him a place by the riverbank. Only that he has to make sure to provide him a house of the same size, as it says, of the same size as it says in the Mishnah. So therefore, Kamash Malon, that's what the Mishnah wants us to know, is that's what the Mishnah wants to tell us. And Rish Lakish clarifies that we're talking about what he said, Bais Kazeh, and the point is therefore, so he can't say the house collapsed, it's your mazel, because he made it clear Kazeh. A house like this, in other words, the rental is not limited, the lease is not limited only to this house. On the other hand, since he said Kazeh, then he has to keep it the same size and shape and everything else as it was before. Hadron Allah HaShol. The next perek over here, Hamakabel, the first, most of the perek is going to be dealing with dinim of orisim, of tenant farmers, which we're going to talk about a few possibilities. The end of the perek is going to talk about a few other dinim. Now you have like this, when you have a field or a vineyard or whatever, any kind of agricultural land, you don't want to work it yourself. You hire somebody to work it for you. There's three possible ways that it can be arranged, and we're going to be discussing all three of them in our parak. You have what's called an oris, in English it's called a sharecropper, namely where you have, they divide it between them on percentages. If it's a good year, then you're going to get, if it's a good year, you're going to get more. If it's a bad year, you're going to get less, but it's always going to be a certain percentage. So that kind of thing is called an oris in Hebrew. In English, we call it a sharecropper. Then you have what's called a choicher, which is where the deal is he's going to pay a certain fixed amount in rent, a certain fixed amount of produce in rent per year. So we might say, for example, you're going to pay me at the end of the season, you're going to pay me 10 bushels of wheat from this location or whatever. Now, of course, he could end up far ahead of the oris or far behind. If the place produces 100, then he's paying only 10%, and he gets to keep 90% for himself. If it's a bad year and it produces only 5 bushels, then he's not only going to have to give all those 5 to the landlord, but he's also going to have to go buy 5 on the open market in order to pay him. So that kind of thing is called a choicher. And then you have the third, and then you have the third kind, which is where the rental is going to be paid in money. That kind is called a socher. We're going to be touching on the socher a little bit in our perek, but mainly we're going to focus on the oris and the chocher. The general term for all these arrangements is mekabel. You're receiving the field, and you're on one or another of these types of contracts, and you're going to be working it on behalf of the balabas. So we're going to deal with this. So the first half of most of our perek is going to deal with various dinim relating to those kinds of business relationships between the owner of the field and the one who's working for him. So the Mishnah says, "Hamakabel sodem echaveroi." When a person is makabel a field from somebody else, and that means any of these various kinds of arrangements. Makam shenagu lichzer. So if it's a place where normally they harvest the crop by cutting it, by using a sickle, for example, to cut it, lichzer, then he has to do it that way. He can't decide, in other words, that instead I want to uproot it from the ground for reasons that we're going to see in the Gemara. Lacher, if it's the local custom to pull it out of the ground with the roots. Yaker, then he has to do that. He can't say instead I want to cut it. And you can't say, I want to instead cut it and leave the roots in the ground. Again, as we'll see in the Gemara, why that is. Now Mephoshim point out, you could have, in other words, so if the Mishnah is going to say, I call Kaminig Amadina, what it really means, in other words, if there's no Minhag, that's going to be later in the Perek. Yeah, so whatever the local Minhag is, you have to follow. Hakol Kaminig Amadina, everything follows the local Minhag. Whatever the local farmers do is what you the tenant farmer has to do in terms of harvesting the crop. Mishnah continues, Kishem Shachokin Batvua. Now when it comes to dividing up the crop, just as they divide the grain or the produce or whatever the normal percentages are, so they also divide the tevin and the cash. Now, tevin and cash are both straw. Tosfos discusses over here that the actual difference in meaning would be that what now you have like this: when you harvest grain, you cut the stalk, and some of the stalk goes along with the grain, and later on you remove it in the threshing and winnowing process, and then you have some of it remains attached to the grain. Tosfos says what you harvest together with the grain is called tevin. What remains stuck to the ground is called cash. And Tosfos brings, you have the various psukim that bear out that difference. For example, when Eliezer comes to Rivka and she tells him we have plenty of food in the house for your animals, she tells him we have tevin. So therefore, tevin necessarily has to be what was harvested together with it, because otherwise they can't very well offer him cash, which is still attached to the ground. Similarly, when you have in Parashas Shmos, when Pare is saying, I won't provide straw for the bricks anymore, and you have to collect your own, lakoshish cash la tevin, they had to collect cash to serve as tevin, because the tevin itself has already been used for animal food and has already been taken to everybody's house. Tosfos explains there are in further parts in the Gemara over here where it seems to use the word tevin as referring to what's still attached to the ground, but nevertheless, what it means is, in other words, you're using cash that's still attached as if it was tevin. Anyway, so you're the same way. So whatever the percentages are, if the percentage is, for example, that the oris is going to be getting, let's say, half of the crop, then he's also getting half of the cash and half of the tevin. Kashem Shachokin by Yayin. Similarly, if it was a vineyard, the same way as they divide the wine according to the percentages, Kachokin Bismodus, so they also divide the branches that are pruned off the vine, that each of them is entitled to their percentage of those. The Gemara in Brachas has a story, by the way, where Rav Huna one time has hundreds of barrels of wine of his go sour, and when the Chachamim went to be Menachem Ovel him for that, for such a tremendous loss, they tell him, you know, after all, you have to think in, is there anything you did wrong that the Eibishter caused this to happen to you? They go back and forth on it. Eventually, it turns out that Rav Huna had not been given his oris, his fair share of the branches, like we're saying here in the Mishnah. And Rav Huna says, yeah, but the guy's stealing a lot of them for himself anyway. Why should I have to give him extra? And they tell him, you know, if the guy's stealing, take him to Beis Din or something. You can't go steal back from him. sort of Horner accepts on himself that he's not going to do that anymore. He will give the guy the fair share. And if he continues stealing, then he'll take him to Beis Din. And the Gemara discusses over there two possibilities of what happened. One is that a nest happened and the vinegar turned back into wine. And the other is that the price of vinegar went up so much that he was able to sell it for the price that he would have gotten for it as wine. Anyway. The Mishnah continues, of a kanim, they also divide up at the end of the season the sticks that are used to hold up the grapevine. The grapevine itself won't naturally grow higher. It'll sprawl all over the ground. So sometimes you put up a trellis or something to hold it up. Sometimes instead you stick sticks into the ground and you have the vines rest on those. So now at the end of the season, when they're done with the harvest, then they also divide up the sticks evenly between them. And both, by the way, both of them have to supply these sticks that are needed for the vineyard. Every year there are new ones. It actually points out the artist's job is to work the land, to guard it or whatever, all other kinds of things like that are the responsibility of both of them. Rashi points out that this the first half of the Mishnah, when we said that whether it's cutting or whether it's reaping or whether it's pulling out of the ground or whatever, would apply equally well to any kind of kablan. The rest of the Mishnah that talks about dividing things necessarily is talking only about an oris, because a choicher, you're not talking about percentages, he's just paying a fixed amount. Okay. So the Gemara says, Tana, we learn in a braisa, mokum shenagu lichtzer, in a place where they reap the crop with sickles, for example, ein rashoi lacquer, then you're not allowed to pull it out of the ground. Lacquer, ein rashoi lichtzer, and if it's something you pull out of the ground, then you can't decide on your own to harvest it, to cut it, or shnein ma'akvin zalzeh. Either one can prevent the other one from doing differently than what's usually done in minigam mokum. The reason is, lichtzer ein rashoi lacquer. Why is it when it's a place where they normally reap it, where they normally cut it from the ground, then you're not allowed instead to pull it out? Because the owner of the field can say, but in the tispan li aroi, I want my field to have tevin in it. Now here Tosfos points out, properly speaking, tevin would mean, like we said before, what was already harvested with the grain, but he means, in other words, that I want some cash to be left as if it was tevin. In other words, that normally the tevin is used to, among other things, to make fertilizer. I want the cash that's left attached to the ground to serve that function. So this way the field will be better fertilized. But Hai Omar, meanwhile, the other way around, the Bala Soda can say instead it should be pulled out of the ground. And he can say, on the other hand, Loi Matsina, or the other way around, rather, the tenant farmer, the oris, or the makabel, can say, Loi Matsina, I can't, it's too much of a, if it's a place where normally they reap, then he can say, I don't want to instead pull it out of the ground, because it's harder for me to do that. Similarly, lacquer ein rashoi lichtzer, if it's the other way around, if it's a place where they normally pull it out from the ground, then neither one can decide on their own. Then instead, it should be it should be reaped from the ground. Hi, Omar, the Balabos can say that not, but in it to knock it out. On the contrary, I want my field to be as clean as possible and not to have leftover straw in it. Let's say, for example, Rashi says it's already a very fertilized field and it doesn't need any more. But Hayomer, and conversely, the Oris can say, but in a Tivna, on the other hand, I want to have some Tevin as well. And if you make me leave the roots in the ground, I'm not going to have it available to give to my animals or whatever. In fact, for that matter, Marshall points out the owner of the land himself can say, I want Tevin, but whatever. The point is, in other words, each one has a valid argument against the other. And when it said, when the Braisa had said, Shnei Ma'akvin, Zel Zel Lamali, why does the Braisa have to continue that either one can prevent the other? What else is it adding? In other words, we already said that either one, that you can't change. And the answer is, that's the Ma'tam comma. The Braisa is giving us a reason. Ma tam litzer einer ashoy lacquer. Why is it when the local minag is to reap, then you can instead pull out of the ground lacquer einer ashoy litzer, and vice versa? Mishum the shnei ma'akven zalze, because each one has a valid claim against the other in terms of how difficult it will be to do, and in terms of whether there's going to be fertilizer left in the field versus having it available for your animals, etc. And therefore, each one has a valid claim. The point being, in other words, if it wasn't for that, that wouldn't be good enough. That wouldn't be a good enough reason. You can't say that you should just follow the local minhag where there's no logical reason for it at all. So therefore, So the Shita Mekubetzes brings and Tosfos Yomtiv brings that you can't force a person to follow a minigam adina when there's no logical reason for it. Otherwise, it's almost like midas sedoy. But here we're saying that each one has a valid claim that that therefore he can prevent the other one from changing the way things are usually done in this area. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, I think I skipped this actually when we learned the Mishnah. Yeah, I skipped the line in the Mishnah. Lachrish achar of Yachrish. Yeah, I skipped the line in the Mishnah that when the minig is, when the local minig is after the harvest, they plow the field again, Yachrish, then he's obligated to do that in order to get rid of the weed. So when the Mishnah had said Lachrish achar of Yachrish, the Gemara says Pshita, isn't that obvious? Of course, minig amadina, you have to do that. The answer is loy tzricha, but asra deloy menachshi. The case would be it's a place where they don't usually pick out the weeds during the growing season. But also even Nakish, he went ahead and did that. He went ahead and went to the trouble of pulling out all the weeds at that time. Maud tema omale. You would think now at this point you can tell the bala sada haidin akishna. Exactly, that's the reason why I went to all that trouble during the growing season to pull out all the weeds. I died to delik the rivnala, is I had in mind that this way I shouldn't have to plow it later. You're saying I have to plow to get rid of the weeds. Why should I? I pulled out all the weeds during the season. Kamash Malan, therefore the Mishnah is telling us no good. If he wants to do that, he should specify to him the deal is I'm going to weed during the season, and therefore I don't have to plow at the end. And if he doesn't, then he's still obligated to plow. The Mishnah had said, Hakol k'minag amedina, everything follows the local minag. So Hakol l'asur yamai, what does that come to? And then, by the way, Hagoris HaGurah brings from the Ramah that says that even if the other, he doesn't even have to say it, if he says it explicitly, and the other guy doesn't have to say, okay, even if he's just quiet, once he sees that the guy says, I want to do that, then that's good enough. Okay. Hakol Kamina Gamadina, so Hakol Lasuya Mai, what does that Hakol come to include? Lasuya Hodotan and Abonin, it comes to include other things described in a Braisa. Mokum Shinogu Lahaski Ilonis Agabe Karka. In a place where the minag is that, now like this, you have the otis taking care of the field where you're growing grain or beans or whatever it is, or vegetables or whatever it is. If the local minag is that you also include the trees together with it, that the otis is also going to get a percentage of the payers from the trees, even though he's not really working on the trees, maskirin, then that's included automatically as well, because that's minag amadina. Mokum shaloi nagu lahaskir ein maskirin, and a mokum shein nagu lahaskir ein maskirin, in a place where they don't usually do that, then it's not automatically included with the field, and the artist is not entitled to his share of the payers. So the Gemara asks, "Makom shenagru lahaskir maskirin." You're telling me in a place where they normally include the trees with the field, then it's automatically included, and the artist therefore is entitled to his share. Pshita, isn't that obvious? The answer is loitzricha the kula alma yavi betilta. The case would be, let's say that it's a place where normally the artist is given 2/3 of the crop, and the balabas gets only 1/3. But also over yavi beriva, instead, this particular landowner is willing to take only 1/4. Tosfos, by the way, wonders, why is the owner getting such a small percentage, only 1/3 or only 1/4? Don't we usually find in other places that the balabas gets much more than the artist? And so Tosfos draws a distinction between who's providing the seeds for the planting. If the balabas is providing the seeds, then he gets a larger percentage. If the balabas is not providing the seeds, the artist is responsible for providing them, then the artist will get a larger percentage, and it may even be more than half the crop. Anyway, the point is, in other words, that here the artist is being given a larger percentage than he normally would. Ma'u de tema de omale. You would think now the owner of the field can say, "Hi de batzvi loch." The reason why I took even less than usually I would in this area, adaita de lo yehivna loch beilonis, is because I had in mind that will offset. I won't give you from the fruit of the trees any percentage of that, but instead you'll get a larger percentage of the grain or whatever it is that we're growing. Kamash Malan, again, the Braisa is telling us, no, he should have told him explicitly, and if he didn't, then just the fact that he gave him a larger percentage of the crops doesn't exempt him from giving him from the trees. Similarly, the Braisa said, Mokum Shinagu Shaloy Lahaskir Ein Maskirin, in a place where the trees, where the fruit of the trees is not included in the Otis's portion, then they're not included. Again, the question is Pshita. And the answer is Leitzricha de Kula Alma Makabli Biriva VaOzali or Kibla Betilta. The other way around. Normally, the Arisim are going to get 3/4 of the crop, and he decides to give the Balabas 2/3 of the crop, a larger amount. or the other way around, sorry, that that he's normally going to give the, but he's normally himself is going to keep 75% and give the owner 25%, and here instead he's giving the owner 33%. You would think the orist can say, I'm adding and giving you more because I thought that then in return for that, you'll give me some of the fruit of the trees. Again, the Braisa is telling us, again, if he wanted to do that, he should have specified and otherwise not. So those are the chidushim that the Braisa is telling us. We said in the Mishnah, Kishem Shechokin B'Tvor, just like they divide the produce, Kachokin B'Tevin of a cash, so they divide, in according to percentages, the Tevin and the cash, the straw and the stubble. So Amar Rabbi Yosef, B'Bovel Nehigu D'Lo Yavi Tivna La'arisa. In Bovel, the local minhag is they don't give the straw to the oris. He doesn't get a portion of the straw. So the Moses, Amayin Nafkin Minhag, why is that important to know? If there is a person who does give straw to his oris, you should know he's being an extra generous person. We can't derive from him that that's the minhag hamakom. The fact is, Rabbi Yosef is telling us the minhag hamakom is you don't do that. Okay. Now, we said in the Mishnah that there are various things that both of them have to supply. So now the Gemara goes on in details of that. Now you have when you have to have, you can't just have the field open. Ganovim might come in, wild animals might come in. So you have to have various kinds of fencing around the field. So Amar Rabbi Yosef, Buchra v'tafta v'arkavta, when you have the Buchra v'tafta and the arkavta, Rashi explains like this. You have, around the edges of the field, you have a heap of dirt that goes, or a berm of dirt that goes all around the edges of the field. So then, eventually, over time, that gets flattened out. People walk on it or whatever, and over time, it gets flattened out. So the first one that you put, the first layer, is called buchra, like the buchur. Then later on, you add more. It's called tafta, what you added. And then the third layer is called akavta, is lifting it up a third time. You keep on adding dirt to it over the years. So all those things, the koni de chizra, and also the sticks that you put in the ground around the field, with which you're going to use to put up a fence, all of those have to come out of the expenses of the balabais. The oris is not responsible for those because those are basic things that are needed for the field. But chizra gufe, as far as then you have, once you have those sticks set up, then you put like thorns between them to serve as a hedge to keep wild animals and whatever out, that is da'arisa, that's on the oris to do. Plodah d'milsa, the general rule is, kol ikur balma, anything that's mainly needed in order to keep things out, the word balma, Rashi translates as shmira. Tosfos points out that also it means shmira, it means closing. So anything that's basically necessary to close up the field, the balabayis, then that's on the balabayis. The tirusi yiserta, but anything that's needed for extra guarding, in this case, for example, once you have that pile of dirt all around and the konim, that would be basically enough to keep out things. But still, you, the artist, would then have to sit there and watch to make sure nothing gets through. You want to make it easier on yourself. So you want to put up thorns, like the equivalent of barbed wire nowadays, say, to make sure nothing comes in. That's on you, because otherwise that's you're saving yourself some work with that. Tosfos brings from Rabbeinu Chananel a different explanation of buchra and tafta, means they're ditches that are dug around the field outside the fence so that animals don't get in. You have a system of ditches over there, one next to the other, so that there's no footing for an animal, and that way it's not going to jump in. So he explains buchra and tafta and our kavta along those lines, rather than Rashi says the various layers of dirt. Anyway, similarly, the Gemara says, of Omer of Yosef, so again, the general rule is you have the basics versus you have what's extra. Where the basics is on the balabais, the extra is on the oris. Similarly, the Omer of Yosef, Rabbi Yosef says in a similar vein, mora, to provide a spade to be able to dig and hoe around the field, or zvila, and the keli that you use for winnowing, it looks like a large oversized fork, kind of like a pitchfork that you use for winnowing the grain, the davla and the bucket that you use for watering the field, the zavnuka and the skin bag that you use. In some places they use such a thing. All of those, again, the balabais, all of those have to come from the expenses of the balabais, because those are all necessities for the field. Arisa Ovid Beyaori, on the other hand, the artist is responsible for digging the canals, the channels of water that are going to go from the river into the field to water it, because, in other words, again, that's just to make things easier for himself, so he doesn't have to schlep the water all the way from the river. Okay. We said in the Mishnah, Kashem Shechokin by Yayin, we said just like they divide the wine between the Oris and the Balabas, Kachokin Bizmodus of Akanim, so they divide the branches and the sticks. So the Gemara asks, Konim Mai Abintayo, what sticks are we talking about? Amid Vedab Yanek, Konim Amuchlokin, it means smooth sticks, or so we actually translate them smooth as peeled, or the Mephoshim translate them as forked sticks, Shabahen Ma'amidna Sakfanim, they use those to hold up the grapevine so they don't sprawl all over the ground. There's a medrash, by the way, that says the Jewish people are compared to a grapevine, because just like we're saying over here, a grapevine is held up by dead sticks, the same way we Jewish people are held up by the source of the others, even though they're long gone from the world. Anyway, the Mishnah had finished off with Shnei Masak and Esakanim. Both of them supply the sticks at the beginning of the season. The Gemara says, Lomali, why do we need to be told that? Of course, if they're dividing the sticks, it means they provided them to begin with. And again, the Gemara says, Ma Tam Komar, the Mishnah is giving us a reason. Ma tam shneim chokin makanim. Why are they dividing them at the end of the season? Mishum de shneim sapkanas akanim. Because to begin with, at the beginning of the season, both of them were obligated to supply them. So therefore, in effect, each of them owns half the sticks or whatever percentages they did, and therefore each of them is entitled to their percentage of the sticks that are left at the end of the season. Okay.